There's three sides to every story. There's my side, your side, and the truth.
Which Kelly are you?
Edward. People call me Ned.
I photograph what my conscience asks me to.
Ned, they want to have him in the movie!
Mad Max 2. It's my kind of movie.
Shut up! Shut up!
Your friend can't come backstage.
Oh, he's disabled. I'm his carer.
You're blind.
He's an equal opportunity employer.
The kids who are sick cannot do the hip-hop anymore.
G'day folks and welcome to another episode of The Curb. My name is Andrew Pearce and this is a podcast that takes a look at Australian film, culture and a whole bunch more. This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Whadjuk people of Noongar Nation and I pay respects to their elders both past, present and emerging. This particular episode, well, it's a part one. If you clicked on the link and you saw the title and all that kind of stuff, you saw that it's part one and there's going to be a part two which is going to be dropping in a couple of days, but today you're going to hear first part of my interview with the director Keir Roche-Turner, whose film Wormwood Apocalypse is, well, it's recently had a screening at Brisbane Film Festival. It launched there. It's going to be screening at the Sydney Film Festival on Saturday, the 6th of November. Tickets are selling quick. Monday, the 8th of November, it's sold out. Tough luck if you wanted to go on Monday night. No joy there. However, if you're in Melbourne, you can still catch this particular film. It's going to be the closing night film at the upcoming Monster Fest, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary. It's going to be excellent there. That's going to be on Sunday, the 12th of December at 8 p.m. Cinema Nova, Melbourne. And I believe that tickets are really flying out the door. Having watched this film, I thoroughly enjoyed it. If you are a horror fan, if you love the first film, you are in for a treat with this one. And I think that, you know, genre fans and zombie fans and all that kind of stuff are really going to enjoy this. And most importantly, I think that fans of the films that, well, you'll hear in the discussion that Keir and I have here, the films that really inspired Keir quite a bit, you're going to enjoy this too. So if you're a Mad Max fan, if you're an Evil Dead fan, you're going to enjoy this particular one. And the key thing is too, is that I don't think you need to have seen the first Wormwood film to appreciate or understand the lore or the legacy of what's actually going on here with Wormwood Apocalypse. It had been a little bit of time before I actually saw Apocalypse since I had seen the first one. And I revisited the first one after watching Apocalypse and, you know, my memory of it was still fresh. So I think it's a lot of fun. Highly recommend it. Anyway, enough of beating around the bush for me, guys. I'm not going to be able to play a trailer because the trailer that is available is just a whole bunch of noises and it's visually exciting. I'm going to stick it in the show notes here because I highly recommend checking it out. There is a bit of a nice tease of one of the villains in the trailer itself. So here you go, some nice music, and then we'll jump into the interview with Keir. Make sure, again, folks, stick around. Part two will be dropping in a couple of days' time. Thanks.
Now tell me, Andrew, did you take Wormwood out and put it up on your shelf there?
Of course I did. Of course I did.
The little touches. I love that. Wormwood right next to a fluffy penguin. Perfect.
That's it. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. The first dog on the moon stuffed toys there.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
I've got it next to Road Games and above the Nightingale. And
Road Games. Yeah, wow. Now, so is that the Jamie Lee Curtis Road Games? Or the?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Wow. Yeah, like an 80s Ozploitation throwback there. That's one of Quentin Tarantino's favourite Australian films, apparently.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So that's the Umbrella disc, which has got, I believe it's got the interview that he's done with somebody on it from Not Quite Hollywood. So
great doctor.
Yeah.
Great
doctor. Yeah. Oh, gosh. I have that many copies of it. I think I'm on my fourth or fifth copy. Every time that Umbrella puts a new copy out, I have to pick it up. You have to. It's got the same special features. It's the same film, but you have to put it out there.
I embarrassingly, that documentary taught me more about Australians than almost any doco I've watched. Didn't know a lot about the 70s exploitation era until I watched that. Like, all that stuff. Like, who is that famous stuntman? Is it Grant Page?
Yeah, Grant Page. And Stunt Rock is coming out on Blu-ray soon, too, as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be great to see, revisit that.
Yeah. I watching even just the clips from those films was so exciting. I was just like, oh man, we were doing it. Like, we were making Grant Page is like a crazy beer swilling Jackie Chan. Like, what an interesting character. Yeah.
It's insane. I interviewed Brian Trenchard Smith
a couple of years
ago. And he's
got a real internet presence, man. He's everywhere. What a lovely guy.
It was funny. I had a chat with him for about an hour, and I could see at the end of the hour, he was supposed to go out for lunch, and his partner was behind him going, excuse me, Brian, we've got to go. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. I had no idea. And he just gets lost in his own thoughts. But the stories about filming Man from Hong Kong and what he used to do with that was just quite nuts. There was just almost no safety in some regards. You know, it was just a bit bonkers.
Like a scary time. And like, it was sort of, it seemed like it was almost socially acceptable to be a dangerous hero back in the 70s, like just in general. Whereas now it's just like safety and like correct and appropriate behavior and words on set paramount. It's hard to make badass films now, Andrew, because it's such a different time. You know, we're all policing all of our activities so carefully. And it's such a good thing that we are. I think, safety is super important. Everybody's got to be nice to each other. It's so great, but it's hard to be, horrible, pushy directors, which is great, but it's less fun. It's less fun. It looked more fun in the 70s, didn't it? You play 7 rounds of cricket, drink 14 beers, and then you do the first take of the take of the day, Those days are over.
Yeah, drive your car through a caravan or something like that. It's just, the things that were done then just couldn't be done now.
Have you seen that photo of, like, it's from the original Mad Max, and it's like a bike just going at 200 miles an hour, and the DOP is just sitting behind the guy filming across the top of the helmeted head. Not even sure the DOP has a helmet on. Like, they're just...
Yeah, probably not.
It doesn't even look like he's strapped in, and it's just like, bah! Like, it's insane. Like, those are the days, just reckless, superheroes of Australian cinema. You know?
Yeah, and the war stories you hear from that, I mean, the amount of people that were injured and going off to hospital and coming back the next day and things like that, it's just...
When I was about 9, my mum used to date a guy who was sort of close to some film industry types. I remember being at a party when I was about 9 and meeting this giant bikey of a man with a giant beard, and he had 100 stitches in his head. He looked like Frankenstein. And that was from the original Mad Max, and he was telling stories about, falling off the bike and smashing his skull open and then, going back to film the next week. That was my first foray into the idea that these movies happen in reality, that they're not just made in Valhalla and then cast down to us. People make these things. I remember being very, very affected by that conversation with that troll-like human being, but it felt very near to that movie at that point. I love the original Mad Max. It's a wonderful film.
Did that linger in your mind growing up? Like, whatever happened to that man, I want to do it.
Yeah, it lingers in my mind even now. Like, I mean, the Mad Max is such a mythological film for all of us. To be able to talk to someone, even at that age, 9, I'd seen it like 2 or 3 times, and this is like an R-rated action film, like things were different when I was a kid, it was like meeting somebody from like a Celtic myth, it was like me, Grendel, you're just like, oh my God, you were there? Like, you were there when when they made that? Like, human beings made that? Like, I thought it was mythology or something, And then you realise, that's what I got very excited that, and the guy who, used to put those parties on had a collection, a guy called Chris, basically like my uncle. He had a collection of like thousands of movies. And so he, the parents would have these parties and us kids would sit in there watching Blade Runner and Apocalypse Now and Mad Max 1 and 2. And, that's when sort of the excitement for watching films and just being inundated with cinema sort of started for me. And then, you get your hands on a Hi8 camera and you start making little, movies with your brothers in the backyard, and that's where it starts, It leads to harder stuff.
How do you think that's changed over the years? Like the accessibility and the manner for kids. I've obviously got mobile phones and stuff, so you know the manner of making films has changed. But do you feel that there might still be that drive for kids who have grown up watching films? It just might be a different type of film that they're making, I guess.
I think it's the same thing of like even just the last generation to my generation. Like every generation, because of technology, things seem to get easier and more accessible. The one thing that doesn't get easier is it's once you pick up a camera and start mucking around, you realize very, very quickly it's a lot harder than it looks. You know, it's like somebody looking at a rat and going, I could do that, and then buying some paints and going, okay, I'm maybe sub-Ken Doan at this point. I'm not Rembrandt. It's going to take a long time, you know, and it does. It takes decades, and it, you know, to even make something halfway good, let alone something great. But the thing that used to kill me was, you know, I mean, I'd get a higher camera, but it didn't look like film, and it killed me. Like, it didn't look like Apocalypse Now. It didn't look like Goodfellas, you know, like it just looked like the shitty video, you know, thing. It looked horrible. But that's all we could get our hands on. And also you shoot and you have to edit in camera. So I learned to edit in camera. I go, okay, you're going to do this. And you could only do one take because you can't do multiple takes and then edit it. So we'd do this film, these little mini films, and we'd have to cut in camera and plan as we went. And then if you didn't get the take right, you'd rewind and do it again. So in between every edit, this horrible video kind of distortion. But, you know, now, like if, you know, a 13-year-old who wants to make a movie can get the latest iPhone and they're shooting stuff that looks like, you know, the latest Michael Bay film. They can edit on their phones. You know, they can get, you know, like a version of After Effects and learn how to do visual effects pretty swiftly. You know, there's online tutorials to show you how to have a meteor hit Earth. You know, I mean, that used to cost like hundreds of thousands of dollars for one shot, and now you can do it, you know, in pretty much one day you can work out how to do that. So the accessibility and the ability to make amazing content is, you know, so much easier than it was when I was a kid. But it still doesn't mean that you can just instantly make good stuff, because so much of it is about imagination and storytelling and having those original ideas, you know, sort of having the craft behind you to make something that is, you know, feels visually dynamic, you know. Yeah.
So when you're building something like Wormwood, do you start off with a Bible? Do you start off with an idea of or storyboards and then work towards the script? Or does the script come first and then you work towards the Bible and the storyboards?
Well, the original Wormwood started with just an idea where we got sick of waiting for George Miller to make another Mad Max. It had been like almost a couple of decades, you know. Ironically, it took us so long to make Wormwood that he, you know, made and released Fury Road by the time, you know, we were sort of releasing ours. But yeah, we just wanted to see Mad Max. And like, we're like, okay, well, we want to do something where we can make a Mad Max vehicle, dress people up in leathers and, you know, have sawn-off shotguns and people running around, you know, in like a post-apocalyptic world. But we knew that we didn't have a lot of money, and we knew that if you don't have a lot of money, you're not going to make a film that's going to look very good. So the best thing to do is do a horror film. And, you know, you look at cinema history, and the three things that pop up are George A. Romero, Peter Jackson, and Sam Raimi. So Evil Dead 1, Bad Taste, and, you know, sort of the original Night of the Living Dead are, like, just templates for, like, how you make a low-budget, awesome horror film that can also be distributed. I mean, Bad Taste went to Cannes. Evil Dead made a lot of money on its theatrical release, and, like, you know, I think at the time, Night of the Living Dead was one of the most financially successful films of that time, you know, in terms of budget to, you know, making ratio. And so we thought, okay, well, let's take Mad Max and chuck a bunch of zombies in there. You know, let's try and make it look like Evil Dead as much as we can, you know, visually dynamic to make up for the low budgetness of it. And I think we're going to be okay. So we decided to do a proof of concept, just a scene. And we've done that, for a bunch of times now. I don't know why, but for some reason I like to make a proof of concept that doesn't have any dialogue. I'm just like, look, let's just see if this works visually as a world and as a concept, you know, without any kind of, you know, storytelling devices like exposition or any of that stuff. Let's just see if it works. So, you know, we plotted out this idea for a scene, and I storyboarded it very tightly, and we put in, I think, about $7,000 of our own money. We bought a vehicle, you know, built that into a prop Mad Max type vehicle, you know, sourced the costumes ourselves by asking people to give us their old leather biker armor, and then putting a friend of ours at American Football, and he gave us some old football shoulder pads, and, you know, we got the hockey mask, and, you know, just sort of, you know, made everything ourselves. We sourced makeup artists by sending them the storyboards and the concept and a couple of short films that we'd made, just to let them know that we knew what we were doing. And, you know, we sort of got them to come on board. Basically, everybody just worked for free because they thought the concept was cool. Most of the people on crew were just friends of ours. We shot that. I edited that together and did all the little visual effects myself, and we just put it up online to see what would happen. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, it had, you know, 100,000 views, which doesn't sound like a lot now, but back then it was huge. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was like 2009 or whatever. So within a week, you know, we got, it became viral. I didn't even know what a viral video was back then, but, you know, that's when we knew we had a film. And then we just moved forward, Andrew, until we finished. And it took 3.5 years because we funded it ourselves. And then when we finished, it did do a little bit. You know, I think people missed those kind of Sam Raimi, Peter Jackson early type films. I think people always want that. People love handmade stuff. You know, if you're good at what you do and you make it handmade and there's like an excitement and an energy behind it, I think people just get, you know, sort of caught up cinematically in your excitement to do it. And it did a little bit of similar kind of business to some of those films, you know, I guess what the industry would call a success. You know, it was a bit culty, and, you know, but then it did what I was hoping it was going to do, which was to launch me into a, quote, career, unquote. Yeah, and here we are, 7 years later, still doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I mean, I remember watching the first one when it first came out and just feeling like the same kind of energy that I felt after watching the Spierig's Undead.
Right.
And I saw that in a tiny little cinema and just felt that same energy that I had, as you're saying, like watching Braindead or Bad Taste as a kid and just being like, oh, this is something that, like, I know I don't have the creative energy to be able to do it or the imagination, but there's something about going, somebody did this with not a lot of money, but a lot of gumption, a lot of power and a lot of imagination, and look at what they've created. It is a really exciting, entertaining film. And that's what I felt when I watched Undead. That's what I felt when I watched the first Wormwood. And here with Wormwood Apocalypse, which is just as much fun, if not more fun than the first one, it's that kind of vision is grown. It's exciting. And it's really exciting to be able to watch you as a filmmaker progress, you know, over the years and see how these ideas have morphed into new ideas. I mean, I just love the opening of this film a lot. It's a lot of fun.
Ironically, the opening for this film was written 10 years ago to be the opening of Wormwood Road of the Dead. And we looked at it and just went, we don't have the money to do that. And not only that, we sort of... we decided instead of starting the whole world building of it all a year into the apocalypse, we thought it more interesting to start with a guy's family on the night of the apocalypse and then work our way towards it. So, yeah, the opening that you said that you liked actually was the first thing we wrote, you know, this idea of this guy alone in the middle of nowhere, you know, God's lonely man in the middle of this zombie-infested post-apocalyptic wasteland. You know, it's such a mythical image, you know, this guy in the middle of an electrified fenced enclosure in a caravan, you know, with a barbecue that runs on zombie breath, you know, getting up and doing his morning routine and exercises, and, you know, he's got a zombie chained to a pole that he uses for boxing exercise, you know, I mean, all this stuff is just such classic apocalyptic stuff, you know. So that was written over 10 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. And yet it still feels, you know, it's organic. It feels brand new and feels part of the whole genesis of everything. How do you and Tristan come up with the ideas for this? Is it lot of late night drinking and sitting around and brainstorming, or is there a, you know, messaging and going, oh, geez, I just thought of this. Why don't we do this?
Kind of all of the above. But also, you know, we get together, we do the work, you know, we just set aside a couple of days here and a couple of days there and just work the boards. You know, we'll get like a big whiteboard and just beat out all the scenes. So the way we write is we try and come up with every single story that, you know, as detailed as we can, you know, very rough ideas of intention for dialogue. We don't actually write any dialogue down. We just do the story beats. We do like a, you know, reasonably detailed beat by beat story treatment together. And then I'll go off and I'll write the draft. I can't write with somebody sitting behind me. So like I just can't do that. So I tend to, I'll write the script out, and then once I start writing scripts, then we sort of turn, it turns a little bit more into your more classic director, writer, creative producer team thing. Sort of gives me notes and we discuss scenes, and, you know, he says, oh, I don't like this, and why does he say that? And then we, you know, kind of work through it like that. But yeah, we work pretty closely in terms of structure and story, and like the world really comes from 50-50, you know, his head, my head.
It's such a fully realized world as well. Like it feels like, you know, outside of the frames of the film, it's going to continue moving. It's going to continue operating. And it's got this whole, you know, the way you layer upon the world and build it up is really exciting and interesting, especially with the different mad scientists and what they're all doing there. You really lean on the different genre tropes, which I found quite exciting. Were there certain pinpoints you just had to get to in this particular entry?
We had such a good run of it on the first film because we financed it ourselves. We had 100% creative control, and it just felt right. We just made exactly kind of the film that we wanted to make, and it was successful. People seemed to like it, even critically, like it did pretty well. And the most important thing on this one was we just had to have that same experience, and it's really hard to get the same experience once you enter the industry. Once you enter the industry, you get into this thing of, I mean, it's mostly money-based where people are like, well, we're going to give you a lot of money, and you have to make that money back, and you're good artists, but we don't really trust you to get the money back. It's not that you're not great, it's just that we think our ideas are more bankable. And so, look, let's go 40% your ideas and 55% my ideas, and then the other 5%, I mean, who knows, you know, will be dictated by actors or demands of agents or whatever crap. You know, you just get caught up in the crap of, oh, that's why it's hard to make it film in the industry, you know. And so we just didn't want to get caught up in the crap of all of that, and so it was very important on this one to make sure that we found a collaborator that would kind of like have the creative respect to go, okay, you guys know what you're doing, I'm just going to back you up, and I'm going to produce this, but I'm not going to try and write it with you. And one of the ways that we had to, one of the only ways that we could do that was to have a really low budget. So we made this for the minimum, below the minimum of what we could make it for, so that we could kind of budget-wise earn the right to have creative decisions just like dictated by Tristan and May, like we did on the first film. And so when we wrote it, we just didn't give a shit. We just went, let's make something that we just make. And so if every scene makes us happy creatively, then we're going to do it. And, you know, we just wrote, you know, this one needed to be Mad Max 2. And if the first one's Mad Max 1, this is Rogue Warrior, if you know what I mean. And let's just make a rip-roaring action film where, you know, we just put in everything that we want to see and set the budget low enough that we get away with just doing whatever the hell we want. And then we might make something original again, like we did with the first one. So, yeah.
How hard is it to make something original in a zombies genre?
I mean, like, you know, the old thing is, oh, I mean, people are bored of, I remember talking to a filmmaker years ago now, very talented, super smart guy. And like, it was embarrassing. I was like, oh, what do you like? What do you hate nowadays? And he's like, I hate anything zombie now. And I'm like, oh, okay. You're talking to a zombie filmmaker. But he was kind of justifying it, just going, look, this, I mean, it's, people just get bored of it, you know. But like, people aren't bored of the zombies. They're just bored of, you know, the same old thing. I'm getting a little bit of like superhero fatigue at this point. And it's not that I don't like superheroes. I adore superheroes. I grew up on comics. I'm just sick of the fact that most of them are the same. They just start to template them and you don't feel like it's fresh. As long as you're coming at a very tried and true, oft-repeated genre, as long as you're coming at that genre with fresh ideas and, like, new energy, it doesn't matter that people have seen it a million. There's nothing new under the sun. It's just the energy behind it, you know? So we're not really doing anything that hasn't been done before, you know, because a lot of our style and stuff really does come from Sam Raimi, Peter Jackson, and Romero. It's just that we're bringing a freshness to it and, like, an originality to the same old thing. So, you know, the key to the success of something is that there has to be a familiarity and a newness at the same time. And if you can bring those two things to a story, it's probably going to be successful. So the familiarity means that people settle back and go, oh, I know what this is going to be. But the freshness is the twist that you give them in terms of concept or even in terms of scene construction, or, you know, you kill a character that otherwise you'd have to let live. You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, all that stuff just comes down to, you know, sort of good writing, but also taking risks. And that's why it's hard in the industry, because a lot of producers and financiers don't want you to take risks. They're like, why are you killing the dog? Don't kill the dog. It's a rule. You can't kill the dog. It's like, who says you can't kill the dog? You know, I don't agree with that. You know, maybe you can't kill the dog in a Tom Hanks movie, but, you know, like, this is a low-budget film. You know, the risk is low. Let's kill the dog. And, you know, at least people might not like it, but they'll talk about it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it's interesting, like, talking about Tom Hanks's films with dogs being killed. Like, Turner and Hooch is memorable because the dog died.
You know? He got me there, Andrew.
Yes. Jesus. Sorry. I didn't.
That's like the worst example I could have
given. but it fits the bill, because most other Tom Hanks films, they'd be like, no, we can't do that. But when they do take that challenge, when they do take that risk, it sticks in your mind. You remember it years later.
And I should have used Charles Grodin as the example. But Beethoven doesn't die, does he? Of course, Turner and Hooch dies.
Yeah,
that was horrible. I'm still scarred by that. Maybe you shouldn't
do it. Those early 90s films, they were, it was a massacre for animals, you know, all dogs go to heaven and stuff like
and
that.
And kids, man. Do you remember seeing that film My Girl with, like, Macaulay Culkin, and he dies? Like, you're like, what? I thought this was going to be like a happy 60s film about childhood and happiness and butterflies. And then Culkin's dead halfway through. You're like, what? Where'd that come from? Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, they really put you through the ringer going up, but yeah.
They did, you know, and our childhood films were like Stand By Me, about some kids trekking to find a dead body. Like, you don't get that stuff anymore, you know? It's a pity.
No. I mean, the kids' films that are being made nowadays are moderately entertaining, but it's, you know, they don't stick in the same way. I mean, I think of something like Coraline, which is not a traditional kids' film, but that terrifies you. You know, that's a horror film,
yeah.
It's a horror film through and through, yeah. But it is so important to find those acts that stick in your mind and those elements of a script that really stick in your mind and make you go 10 years down the line, oh, do you remember this? Do you remember that? And, you know, for me, specifically talking about the Wormwood films, there are certain aspects of it that just stick in your mind where you kind of, whenever you come to a new zombie film, you're like, yeah, it's not doing this like they did that. Like Brooke, who is a great character, wonderful character, has so much inventiveness to this particular character that, and the way that Bianca just, you know, exhibits her on screen, it was full energy.
I had a wonderful compliment from film festival critic, friend of mine, a guy called Christian Bird, just watched this film. And he actually gave me this wonderful critique of it. And he said, in the first 5 minutes, we do this opening where you see Brooke and Barry, and it's like a year into the apocalypse, and they've changed a bit, and the scene is really full on. And he said, in that scene, I sat up and I went, oh, Kia's not messing around here. He's like, this is not what I expected. He's not even sure it's what he wanted. And he's going, that's what I liked about it. It's like, I didn't expect this. And then you cut to this other guy and it's like, who's this? And it's like, I did not expect this at all from the Wormwood sequel. And, you know, and then he said he stopped it. And then he hasn't done this with too many other films. He stopped it and immediately watched it again. He goes, okay, I did not expect that. Like, I need to see that again immediately, you know? And that's the biggest, I mean, that never happens. You know, who watches a film and then watches it again? But, and I took that as the greatest compliment, because we're not sitting here kowtowing to, you know, what we think the fans want or anything. We're just going what we want. And we're assuming that, you know, if it's what we want, it must be what the fans wanted, because that's all we did with the first film. It's just like, whatever we wanted to do, we just did it. And, you know, I think Aronofsky years ago did it where he said that. He just goes, I make films for me, and I assume that there's going to be an audience for that because, hey, we all grew up with the same films and, you know, cultural references. Like, there must be an audience for what I like. And I think that goes back to the idea of the singular vision. I don't like to say auteur because I think it sort of shits on Drew and the cast and all the other people who help on the film. Like, I don't believe in auteurism, but I do believe in the idea of a singular vision. And, you know, you look at Aronofsky and David Lynch and Martin Scorsese and all the greats, they all had a singular vision, and they all, you know, fought the good fight in that they fought for their singular vision, and you feel that in their films. And that's why when a new film of theirs comes out, it's a special occasion, because you know you may not get what you want, but you're going to sit up and take notice because, you know, they're not messing around. You know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Is that even harder in today's landscape in Australian films? Because from what I've seen, you know, as you're talking about before, it comes down to money. There's money involved, then it makes it harder to have that singular vision. But there is a freedom to being a low-budget production, a freedom to being independent. And, you know, there are different scales of independent for sure, and, you know, different views of what being independent is. You know, of course, some people would say that Nitram is independent, even though it was funded by Madman and Stan, but it didn't have government funding, or it didn't have Screen Australia funding.
I don't think anybody wanted to fund that one, you know?
No, at all.
Martin Bryant? No.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Oh, call it Nitram. Yeah, no, good.
Don't.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm such a big fan of Justin Kurzel. Sean Grant is a genius writer. I'm sure it's going to be an amazing film. But, yeah, that would have been very hard to get funded.
Yeah, try and see it in a cinema if you can. I saw it earlier in the year, and it's just, it's been hard to shake. But
I'm still trying to shake Snowtown. Like, I mean, that film got under my skin in a way that no other film has, except for maybe Martyrs.
Yeah, Martyrs is, oof, yeah.
I've got post-traumatic stress syndrome from Martyrs. You know, it's like, watch Martyrs, it's like going to war for a couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. I was listening to a podcast that was talking about Martyrs the other day, and I had to stop listening to it just because I was driving and I was like, I can't listen to this while I'm having, because it's bringing back too many memories of the film.
You're getting yeah. Flashbacks.
Yep. But yeah. How hard is it to have that singular vision in Australian film?
It's really hard, but I'm sort of very slowly learning that it's about writing. I mean, I write my own stuff, so of course it is, but it's about the script, you know. Like with Wormwood, we were in a very good position. We were lucky that, you know, we connected with Blake, who had a really solid financial plan for getting this up. And because we had success with the first one, we were able to get away with the idea that we had final cut and like all the creative decisions just like laid out for us. But that's very rare. Most of the time, you do need to write towards the idea somebody's going to give you a couple of million dollars for your project. And it doesn't matter how talented or awesome you are. Most of the time, that's not going to happen unless somebody has confidence in your project's ability to make something financial happen in a marketplace, you know. So you can't just go in with these awesome ideas, you know. You do have to be able to justify it, you know. It has to feel market ready, you know. So film doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, if you want your singular vision to be purely, you know, auteuristic, be a painter or a novelist. Film is collaborative and it costs a lot of money. So there has to be a business aspect to what you're doing. And so that's the struggle. That is the struggle of being a filmmaker, trying desperately to make Taxi Driver, but realizing there's not a market for it. So you have to create that market through being incredibly clever and talented and a good writer and hopefully successful, because, you know, at the end of the day, if your films don't make money, they're not going to keep financing you, and you'll end up making, you know, stop motion animation in your cupboard.
That's a great Keir Roche Turner talking about his new film, Wormwood Apocalypse, which launches very, very soon. And if you're in Sydney, well, you'll be able to check it out this coming weekend, November 6th. You've got to be quick, though, because tickets are selling out quickly. And if you're in Melbourne, make sure to head over to Monster Fest and pick up your tickets soon as well. I'll stick links for both of those in the show notes. And if you're in Brisbane, hopefully you enjoyed the screening that recently screened there. I certainly enjoyed watching it. It was a lot of fun. So this was part one. Part two will be dropping in a couple of days' time. And part two, I really enjoy where the discussion goes from there. I ask Keir about what it means to be creative and how he knows that he's good at what he can do. That's a bit of a difficult question to answer. And I'm sure that if you're creative and you're somebody who's able to do creative things, that you've never actually thought about that or tried to ask yourself that question, because it is a bit of a daunting question. And yet I put that to Keir and he gives me a really great answer. I really enjoy where that part of the discussion goes and where we go and explore how drone work works as well. Because I think the drone work in Wormwood Apocalypse is pretty darn impressive. But you're going to have to keep an eye on the RSS feed or keep an eye on the website, thecurb.com.au, for when that drops, which will be on Wednesday. And check out all the other interviews that are going on this week that are celebrating the Sydney Film Festival. It launches this weekend. A lot of great films, a lot of great Australian films. And keep in mind, even if you're not in Sydney, there is an actual online component which is coming up very soon as well. So you can certainly celebrate this festival from afar, just like we did earlier in the year with the Melbourne International Film Festival. I love when that happens. It makes me very happy from as a Perth person, being able to celebrate these great festivals from afar. Enough of me, folks. Head over to patreon.com/thecurbau. Support this website. As little as a dollar a month, it helps keep me being able to do these particular interviews with great filmmakers like Keir. Give us a like on social media. And hey, if you enjoyed this episode and this interview, go over to iTunes or whatever it's called now, Apple Podcasts, I believe it is, and give us a rating and a review as well. It just helps people know that this podcast exists. All right, guys, I'll chat to you in a couple of days. Take care of each other. I'll see you on the next one.